Hello, I'm Denise Howell, and next up on This Week in Law, Evan Brown joins us to say happy holidays. Stefan Spida is vestless in Seattle. We'll discuss the counterintuitive appeal and high price of a 90s sitcom, digital identities, cashless societies, and self-driving plants. All this and more on TWIP.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Stefan Spida, and Matt Curtis. Episode 445, recorded December 7th, 2018. We only take stamps. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. This is our second to last show, live show for the year. We're going to have a best of show at the end of December. So it wouldn't be right to end the year without throwing it back a bit to the early days of This Week in Law and bringing Evan Brown back on the show. Hi, Evan. It's great to see you.
Denise, it's great to see you. It always feels like a homecoming of sorts. So glad to be here. This is a great way to spend a Friday afternoon. So really looking forward to the conversation.
I'm so looking forward to it, too. It's just great to see you. I'm so glad you got the vest memo.
That's right. It's
important.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
That's right. Evan, of course, is a partner with Much Shellist in Chicago. And Much Shellist is at muchlaw.com. And I would be remiss if I did not ask you if there was a Doge meme being invoked by your firm's new URL. What do you think, Evan?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we try to bring it from every angle as we can, but I think it was a little more straightforward than that, I'm sure.
That was the first thing that I thought of when you said, hey, we're muchlaw.com now. Yep. But I do love it. That's a great URL. Also with us is my co-host, Stefan Spida. Hi, Stefan. Great to see you.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Evan. I did not get the vest memo, and I can't see a vest without thinking of the old blog Stuff White People Like, and vests were prominently featured on there. And yet, here I am, vestless and with my entire body, you know, coated in the same layer. It's disgraceful.
Ah, it's okay. If there's a memo for next week, we'll make sure that you get it. And of course, the Black Lives Matter guy, I forget his name, but the Hallmark blue puffer vest. So
right.
The vest world has advanced
expanded, right?
From the old blogging days.
I think he went to Dartmouth. So I think he probably picked it up there.
Could be. Yes, indeed. All right, let's get right into it. We've got a copyright story from Evan's blog to kick off the show. All right, Evan, of course, you're still blogging at internetcases.com. And as was true in the old days, there's always good stuff at internetcases.com. Interesting cases that you monitor and talk about and let us know what's going on. Interestingly enough, in this Strike 3 Holdings case, my takeaway is it really matters who your judge is, who your trial judge is. Why don't you tell us what your takeaways are from this case?
Well, I think that's it's a pretty good observation. And thanks for saying nice things about the blog. You know, it's one of those things that just I can't stop doing. I go for periods of time, you know, months for a while, you know, not writing anything. But yeah, there's still stuff that happens. And believe it or not, it's the end of 2018 and there is still litigation going on about you know, copyright infringement litigation against defendants who are accused of obtaining porn using BitTorrent. So this has like been going on for a decade, and I'm not sure why I even still write about these cases because, you know, it's changed a lot with the rise and fall of, you know, Steele Hansmeyer and all that stuff. But there's still some litigation going on in parts of the world, and Strike 3 Holdings is one of the active copyright plaintiffs in this. And so what happened in the last couple of weeks here, there were two different decisions that came down in the initial stages of the litigation. One was in a federal court in the District of Columbia, the Washington, D.C. district there. And in that case, the judge you know, it was a very satisfying opinion to read from a certain perspective, because it didn't hold any or didn't pull any punches calling Strike Three Holdings a copyright troll. And in that, it's, you know, part of that, you know, that aspect of it played into the judge's rationale in denying early discovery to figure out who the defendant was associated with this particular IP address. Well, then less than a week later, we have a judge in federal court in New York that was like, oh, well, Strike Three isn't really acting bad. They're not really a troll here. We're going to go ahead and, you know, allow the case to go forward against this defendant here. But I think what we're seeing is sort of just a greater awareness of and it's about time, right? Like I said, a decade or so into this kind of litigation, it's finally, you know, we're seeing an awareness of courts that a lot of these plaintiffs are the way they are. And, you know, there is a greater sense of sensitivity toward defendants' privacy and, you know, and the judges in issuing rulings allowing for discovery and how a defendant's going to be identified going forward is taking that into consideration. So two different decisions within a week from two different courts treats the copyright plaintiff very differently and characterizes their conduct as something quite different. So it's an interesting observation to make.
Do you feel like there's been a tailing off of these cases, or they're still just going as strong as they were when we used to talk about them all the time here on Twill?
Well, I'm sure there are people tracking that data out there. I don't encounter them as much because there's not as much litigation here in the Northern District of Illinois for mm-hmm. that stuff. This is where, you know, John Steele and company had set up shop back around 2010. And, you know, he's been since been disbarred, and I think he pleaded guilty for something. I sort of lost track. So there was a pretty active defense practice here in the Northern District, 2010, 2011, in those days. So I don't see it as much. But, you know, Strike Three is still quite active in this type of litigation. And I think that you have the approaches from the courts being different, like we're talking about here in this issue, you know, on this issue here. And so there will certainly be places that are more, I guess, tolerant of this kind of litigation. But I know that there are firms that are still representing these plaintiffs and they're still pursuing this kind of litigation. But I'd leave it to you know, somebody else who tracks it more closely to come up with some real data. There probably is some out there, I would imagine.
Yeah. Stefan, what are your thoughts on copyright trolls and the judges who must preside over their litigation?
Well, first of all, I think the Western District of New York has just raised its hand and suggested that it could sort of become the Eastern District of Texas of porn litigation. Mm-hmm. Not a designation I'd be going for, but you know, it's on them to make that choice. I think copyright troll litigation is really interesting. There's obviously some parallels with patent litigation, but the difference is that these copyright trolls, in my experience, tend to target individual users, often individual users who don't have any financial means themselves to defend themselves. And so there's something a little bit more insidious and sort of morally problematic, I think, about the way copyright troll litigation plays out. So it's always exciting to see a judge like in Washington actually use the word and call someone out for doing this sort of litigation tactic. We'll see. You know, it's not something I follow terribly closely, so I don't have a lot of experience with it. But the limited experience that I do have involves a photographer essentially suing individuals who make a very low income and trying to bankrupt them. And I have to say it's among the worst facts I've seen in this kind of case. And so I don't have a tremendous amount of sympathy for copyright trolls.
Yeah, it is. I was thinking that maybe the kind where you're extorting people for what they may have downloaded has tailed off. But I think that the kind that my sense is that the kind you're talking about, Stefan, where someone has decided they own the rights to something like a database of photographs and is going to monetize that, I think that's on the rise and will continue to be on the rise as algorithms get better at finding where things have been used and how they've been used. Because I think we mm-hmm. went through sort of a wild and woolly time when people didn't realize that they could get in trouble for just copy and pasting things that they find on the internet. And there are probably plenty of people who still think that that's just fine. But a lot of folks have woken up to that, but maybe too late. And they and their friends who have not woken up to it are prime targets for finding a photo, you know, deep in your archives of your website somewhere and going, aha.
And, there's plenty of space for there to be, you know, excusable mistakes made by folks working at digital agencies or, mm-hmm. you know, within the marketing department of a company. I think it's, you know, there's very often infringement that takes place, but there certainly was no intent to, you know, to rip somebody off, to deprive a creative person of their means of living. And then there's still this tension that arises because for as long as there's going to be the provisions in the Copyright Act that allow for the recovery of attorney's fees and costs and statutory damages, you know, there will be an aggressive plaintiff's bar on this. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that in appropriate circumstances, statutory damages and the recovery of attorney's fees can be an important tool for the protection of copyrighted works. It's just that there's those unfortunate situations where there were clearly just innocent mistakes made, but yet plaintiffs' attorneys are very aggressive, and you know, they can make a decent living sending out cease and desist letters and threatening litigation. You know, you get a few $1,000s a pop. That's not a bad way of making a living for a plaintiff's lawyer.
Yeah, and I think I would have called when we first started co-hosting this show together, Evan, back in the day. If you did have asked me then, will copyright law be reformed so that people in that kind of weird situation where it's not clear or they're confused and they don't really intend to be breaking the law or incurring huge liabilities, will the law be changed? I would have said, yeah, probably so. This isn't going to stand for long. But here we are all these years later, and it hasn't changed yet. So
yeah, the world is such a complex place. I think our legislators have had other issues to worry about other than copyright reform. It's one of those things that certainly would be nice to have, but I don't think anybody's, you know, security or, you know, any, you know, for the better part of society, nobody's way of living has been in jeopardy without copyright reform. So those mm-hmm. those things, when they are present, have a great inducement for the changes in the law.
Yeah. All right. Talking about throwing it back to earlier, kinder, gentler times, let's talk about some things at the intersection of entertainment and technology on the law. Not too much to discuss on this front this week, but it has been much in the news. That and much to many people's relief, that Friends is not going to go off Netflix next year. $100 million deal has been struck, so say confidential insiders close to the deal, that will keep Friends on Netflix throughout next year. But there is some tension around that because AT&T, having acquired or I don't know, merged with. I'm going with acquired Time Warner, now owns the rights to those shows and wants very much to have its own streaming service and won't be able to compete with Netflix if it's not able to offer exclusive access to some of its own intellectual property. But for the time being, $100 million was enough to sweeten the pot and keep Friends on Netflix. Are you happy about this, Stefan?
I have never seen an episode of Friends, and I don't know if that's going to change. I used to have this theory that actually I shouldn't say that. I've seen one episode, and that was enough. I used to have this theory that you could only like Seinfeld or Friends; it would be impossible to like both. And I was definitely a Seinfeld person. And I've since met people that claim to like both, but I think the psychological disposition that you have to truly love Seinfeld as it's meant to be loved precludes any sort of equivalent appreciation of Friends, that I'll take that one to my grave. So sorry, Ross and whoever the other people are. I'm just not interested in your zany adventures. Too much of a nihilist, frankly.
I had never considered that dichotomy, but I think you're onto something because I'm probably more of a Friends person. I can appreciate Seinfeld. I can watch Seinfeld. My husband is much more of a Seinfeld person, so Seinfeld is frequently, you know, on tap. But if I'm choosing the show, it's going to be Friends over Seinfeld probably every time. What about you, Evan?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying, Stefan, about Seinfeld. I mean, Seinfeld has so much nuance and so much stuff. You know, you got to, if you're a fan of that, you can, you have the, I mean, you're in a situation where you can become a real fanatic and get into a lot of detail and remember those crazy scenarios that are all about nothing, right? So, but yeah, I guess I watched both Friends and Seinfeld, just like I watched both 90210 and Party of Five. Those seem perfectly compatible, don't you think, Denise? Watching those, both of
them. Absolutely,
you didn't have to be.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I was really surprised when, you know, you put this article in the rundown for today, because I had no idea that Friends was, you know, still this popular. We're not Netflix subscribers, and I had no idea that it was still a big deal and that, people would be upset about it to the extent that it was worthwhile for Netflix to pay $100 million. And that sounds like a lot of money. And, well, it is a lot of money.
It is.
I also saw in this article that Netflix has 130 million subscribers. So that's less than a dollar per subscriber per year. So in, you know, when you're talking about economies of scale, maybe it isn't all that much. And it's, you know, it's pretty clear that it would be worthwhile. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming years. I guess underlying all of this is the massive importance of exclusive rights, and, you know, this dovetails with our discussion of copyright earlier. You know, without the, mm-hmm. it's easy to lose sight of all of the economics here that underlying all of this is the power of the exclusive rights that come from the intellectual property embedded in this content. So big numbers, big interest. It'll be interesting to see how the market plays out. You know, we'll the New York Times article that we read here said something that there were negotiations for Netflix to pay less than $100 million in subsequent years. That seems to me to be different than what one would expect if AT&T has the rights through its ownership of Time Warner. You would think that it could raise the price and probably command that price. So, but you know, this whole market is much more complex than I have any visibility into. But here we are, 2018, end of 2018, and you know, this real hallmark of 90s culture is alive and well. So it makes me nostalgic and a proud member, right smack dab in the middle of Generation X. It's good
yeah.
stuff.
It's a good place to be. I think it's fascinating. And you've hit right on it that there are a couple of things about this that strike me. The first is sort of the evergreen nature of a product like this, where it's finding a whole new audience simply because it's funny and it's a kind of escapism, I think, that maybe people crave when they're Netflix and chilling these days. So the fact that something can run its course sort of into the ground, run its course with one generation and then have a whole new life with another generation. That speaks a lot about how important management of those intellectual property rights are.
Yeah. And isn't that crazy? Go ahead. I wanted to raise a thought, but go ahead and finish up what you were going to say there. Don't let me forget.
The other thing that occurs to me is that this would never have happened if the world that we were living in had forked into people could only get at this kind of entertainment via online or digitally via BitTorrent or buying, you know, the DVDs. The whole Netflix as an entity has been so important in bringing about this universe that we exist in now, the whole streaming universe where AT&T wants to be able to stream its own stuff. And I think that's what the New York Times article was getting at, that when Netflix isn't the exclusive provider of this popular show, then it will be a contract that would be worth less to them to have the rights. That's how I read that. But anyway, what was the point you wanted to make?
Well, I'm not enough of a copyright historian to know this for sure, but I seem to think that at some point in the early days of copyright in the U.S., the term of copyright was, 14 years, something like that. So it's interesting that had that never changed and there had not been this expansion of the duration of copyright, now life of the author plus how many years is it?
70.
70. Mm-hmm. and I guess this would be different because it's all work made for hire. So it's not the copyright for the Friends episodes are different than that, but it's much longer, right? So this would have long, this content would have long been in the public domain if we were still under the same copyright, very shorter, much shorter duration from the early days of copyright in the U.S. I guess the other totally different kind of point is in 1996 or whatever, what would we be thinking had somebody said, oh, in 22 years from now, the phone company is going to own the rights in this company. What's AT&T have to do with Friends? And yeah, here we are.
Absolutely. Yeah. Any final thoughts, Stefan, before we move on?
Yeah, I think there's the copyright angle, the interesting point here to me is there's this, basic copyright theory that it's supposed to reward creativity and encourage people to come up with original things. But it's clear in this example that what the law is doing is rewarding not creativity per se, but this incumbent player who owns rights to something that was created a long time ago. And that $100 million that's flowing to the creators or owners anyways of Friends could have gone to developing 15 or 20 new shows that you could have been new and relevant and really employed some creative types who could have made the next Friends or something equivalent. And instead, because of the incentives being structured the way that they are, all that money is flowing towards something that's been around for a long time and but under any sensible system maybe should belong to the public at this point. So it's an interesting way in which the tension baked into the Copyright Act sounds good in terms of what it's supposed to be doing. And I'm sure the people getting paid $100 million are happy. But imagine all the people who could have used that money to make something new and great rather than indulging in our nostalgia. And I think that, it's something to think about as we continue to reward incumbents under the guise of rewarding creatives.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I'm going to make your earlier point about being a Seinfeld or a Friends person and the mutually exclusive nature that may entail. Our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law will be Seinfeld or Friends. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer in the United States or some other kind of professional who may be able to listen to our show for professional credit in your field. We put these phrases in so that if you have to verify that you actually watched or listened to the show, this should help you be able to do that. If you go to twit.to/MCLE, there's some resources for lawyers in the U.S. to help guide you toward perhaps applying for credit in your jurisdiction. We'll put another phrase in before we wrap up the show today. This next story is a little bit random. I stuck it in because it sort of weirdly reminded me of the story we've referenced a couple of times on the show where Jet Li told his story of declining to be in the sequels to the Netflix movies. He was in the first one because he was concerned about giving over the entire body of work of his martial artistry to a film studio to do what it will with it. There is a piece at Motherboard about how Disney is creating video game teeth. And so here we have someone who they only describe this person as the volunteer. I don't even know if this person is being paid from this reporting. I certainly hope so, because here someone has taken the opposite approach from Jet Li and is giving over the rights to the digital imagery of their chompers in the most weirdly sci-fi kind of fashion of it having been captured. If you read the Motherboard piece, you'll think that you've dropped into some clip out of the movie A Clockwork Orange. In fact, they specifically reference that. And it is just so strange. So this poor person had to sit with this terrible contraption, prizing his jaws open, and then all kinds of lights blasting at him and very detailed photography being taken of his dental arrangement so that Disney can have accurate teeth to use in video games. And I just thought this was a weird place that we've arrived in the world. What do you think, Stefan?
What I think is interesting about this is going back to the copyright point, the more realistic you make something and then portray it in a video game, the weaker the protection is under copyright law. At the same time, you know, that creates this opening that, you know, maybe this method, something about the way they're doing this could be patentable. And there was a recent decision out of, I believe it was the Central District of California in McRow, which is a sort of long-standing video game litigation that went up to the federal circuit, where there is techniques for animating the movement of lips that had been patented. And that was challenged under Section 101 as not eligible under the patent laws. The district court found that the technique was not patentable. The federal circuit reversed and found that it was based on the various grounds relating to the rules that were used to animate the lips not being subject matter ineligible. Went back to the district court on remand, and the district court again invalidated the claim, this time under Section 112, finding that the rules were not sufficiently disclosed in the specification. And so this is all just a very long-winded way of saying that it's an interesting problem that the video game developers could be walking themselves into here by making something that's so realistic that it's not easy to copyright, while at the same time perhaps not thinking about the evolution and the patent laws in a way that will allow them to protect it through a patent. And so downstream, it'll be interesting to see what happens here. Maybe they'll come up with a technique that anybody can just rip off. So looking at the IP angle here, I think there's kind of an interesting gap in how they can protect this.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought of it from that perspective. I was sort of the only rights holder perspective I was really considering was the poor guy in the chair and the fact that he's giving over his teeth. But you raise a really interesting point. Evan, any thoughts?
Not until that last thing you said right there. I mean, at what point would this trigger a right of publicity? You know, if somebody had very distinctive teeth, otherwise, I don't think you're very identifiable. And then I guess I don't know if I could trace it or tie it to a particular thought, but there's just this whole idea of how copyright plays into this. And I'm reminded of the days back in, I guess it was like the 1860s, when President Lincoln signed a bill that amended the Copyright Act to actually bring photographs into the scope of the subject matter of copyright. And it wasn't until the 1880s that there was a case that made it all the way up to the Supreme Court called Cerrone. I forget the other parties, but I know it was over that photo of Oscar Wilde where they actually, established definitively that photographs can be subject to copyright. And the thinking up to that point was, well, is it just a recreation of nature or something in something that just happens to exist? Is the photograph something that just replicates that, and so it doesn't have that requisite amount of originality under the Copyright Act? So, even if there is a thin protection here, I think there would still be sort of the same theme as to the copyrightability of this subject matter, even though it's just a sort of replication of something that is already existing in the real world. So interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff. All right, let's move on and talk about MasterCard, Microsoft, and privacy. A couple days ago, MasterCard and Microsoft issued a press release and announced that they're working on a digital identity service. They announced a strategic collaboration between the two of them that would allow individuals to enter control and share their identity data their way using their personal devices. The two companies claim that this will streamline and ease the process of utilizing financial, e-commerce, government, and digital services. But the internet, as it is wont to do, has questions. This immediately set off alarms on the part of journalists at Fast Company and The Inquirer and elsewhere who are much disturbed at the notion of a universal digital identity being controlled by a strategic partnership between Microsoft and MasterCard. And if you read the Fast Company piece in our rundown, our discussion points for this week, that is available along with everything else we're going to discuss here today at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're on episode 445. You'll see that the journalist there reached out to MasterCard. Microsoft gave her no comment But MasterCard gave a whole lot of detail, really trying to present themselves in the good guy white hat light here, saying, we know this is a problem for people, both of convenience and security. We're still in the development stages. We're definitely paying attention to making this a consumer-friendly, privacy-friendly, security-friendly product, and that's paramount in our minds. But still, there's a lot of hand-wringing about this strategy that the companies are pursuing. Is this a Seinfeld versus Friends kind of conundrum, Stefan? Can you have Microsoft and MasterCard manage a convenient digital identity and have it be privacy and security friendly, do you think?
No.
No. Okay. Good to know. That really clears it all up. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I think I wish that there was some easy way that you could sort of install a filter on your web browser that allows you to just delete every sentence in a story that is sort of supplied either by a PR person or a marketing sort of spokesperson and just distill automatically, sort of use AI or something to distill a story down to its essence. Because that would be really useful when something like this is discussed, because, you know, using terms like consumer friendly and privacy and security in this context just seems like taking a word and sort of attaching a little spigot to it and then draining the meaning out of it. So all you're left with is letters that have no semantic content whatsoever. And that's what they've done here. So going back to my original answer, no.
Yeah. Okay. I will go with your answer. And I guess maybe this is the Seinfeld Friends dichotomy in action here, because I definitely want to be optimistic about this and think that there's a path where it could not be a privacy disaster. And it does seem to me like my MasterCard at least is saying the right things and paying. Somebody there has studied this issue and has studied the ramifications of this issue. They're talking about making sure that they don't hang on to the data at all, that there's going to be a trusted third party. Now, again, you know, how do you determine what that means and who that is? Who has the data, but the data is going to remain under user control, et cetera. So really, you know, for folks who've been around the digital identity world for decades now, this has been something that people have been struggling with for quite some time. MasterCard's saying the right things. So at least there's one employee there who seems to be on the right track. But can a company like that strategically ally with a company like Microsoft and implement this in a way that's not a disaster? I'm less positive about that future. But it remains to be seen. They're going to give it a go. What do you think, Evan?
Well, I think that they would have the incentive to make something like this work because their business model would benefit from authentication, identity verifying technologies that are more useful. There would be less credit card fraud. And if people have greater confidence when they're going out spending their money, that's clearly going to benefit MasterCard. And, you know, I don't think we know enough about what it actually is going to be or is anticipated to be to, have a factually based skepticism on this. We can surmise that, oh, this could be a disaster anytime anyone is going to go out so far and say, hey, we're going to try to develop this mechanism to provide authentication and identity management like this. Clearly, there's going to, among some commentators, immediately be indignation. And sure, that's a great I won't say the word clickbait out loud, but I will. You know that you can write articles about that and get them to click through much better than you would having it much more optimistic. Like, oh, here's a technology that's going to really provide a substantial benefit to the great majority of people who use it in terms of convenience and access to these kinds of technologies to underserved communities and what have you. That's not nearly as exciting as saying, oh, this sucks and it's going to be a disaster and all, and Microsoft and MasterCard, they're evil and all that stuff. So I guess another way of thinking about this is, you know, you could divide the world, the universe up into two classes of entities who could develop a technology like this. One would be the government. The other would be anybody who's not the government. And mm-hmm. if I had the choice between those two, I would rather it be the category of people, not the government, developing this kind of technology, because for obvious reasons, you know, it seems to be there's obviously nuance with this, but you know, there seems to be less potential for the terrible Orwellian kind of abuse if it's not the government. And then the other thing is, I bet you whatever is in the works here is pretty cool from a technology standpoint. Like I said, we don't know what it is, but it seems to me in the abstract, you know, somebody who is far from being an expert in cryptography or those kinds of mechanisms, I bet you there's something really cool going on here where it really is, or it really is not, just a centralized database that has everybody's information in it, but it's something that in a pretty interesting way will do what it sets out to do, and that is confirm or deny whether an individual using the service is who he or she purports to be. And I bet you that can be done in a way that doesn't require the accumulation of a huge database that has the characteristics, as Professor Grimmelman has described, databases of sensitive information, doesn't have the same kind of characteristics as toxic waste, where if it were to be spilled, it would cause great harm. So, you know, I'm not going to be too cynical about it yet. You know, there's great potential here. I think there's great potential for something like this to have benefits that way outweigh the potential downside and the things that, you know, the bad things that inevitably will happen, hopefully just out on the periphery somewhere.
Yeah, the Fast Company piece on this invokes the issues with when a state implements something similar to this. They talk about India having a program that scans citizens' fingerprints and eyes, which connects all of their personal data from cell phone information to government benefits into one state-controlled apparatus. And we've been hearing a lot, too, about China planning to use a countrywide citizen identification system that would give people social credit scores about the way they behave. And we're talking there about two very Orwellian sounding government systems. Like you, Evan, I'm more a fan, I guess. I think that something like this is inevitable. And I am more of a fan of private enterprise trying to get it right than the government, especially when, you know, MasterCard is saying things like, the service will allow the data to sit with its rightful owner, the individual, and wouldn't involve amassing personal data in honeypots vulnerable to attack. In no situation would MasterCard collect users' identity data, share it, or monitor their interactions. Instead, the data would reside with the trusted party, and our service would merely validate the information already provided once an individual has decided to do so. This is about giving the individual control over who sees their information and how it's used, which all sounds great, but, you know, the devil's in the details, and we'll see how it all shakes out. The other thing that occurs to me in thinking about this, there was a great segment on The Daily Show last night about moving to a cashless society and how more and more retail outlets are just flat out refusing to take cash because they don't want to have it on hand. It's a security risk for them. It's more convenient just to process everything via credit card, but that there is a whole segment of society for whom that's simply not possible. That they are not bank enabled people. So something like this, if it's built around your ability to have a credit card, would fall prey to that digital divide issue as well. Any final thoughts, Stefan, on this?
Yeah, I always find it interesting. I think it's like a quirk of the American character that there's this enormous distrust of whatever the government does. But as long as a private company is doing it, then there's some reassurance there. I think under scrutiny, that distinction between private and public kind of falls apart, or at least it should. And so I, you know, personally get no reassurance if it's a private versus public, because if anything, private companies are not subject to the same types of constitutional scrutiny as the government is. And, you know, if you just delete the word government, because for some, you know, quirk of history in America that has taken on a meaning of some sort of nefarious, inherent nefariousness, and just say public, I mean, it it belongs to the public and is subject to scrutiny in the way that something that is public is subject to scrutiny. And so although the Orwellian notes might be sort of stronger as an aesthetic point when the government's involved, mm-hmm. as a practical matter, you've got something that is subject to scrutiny and is not being sold for profit. And I just don't see any basis based on the way that private companies have behaved over time to trust them more than the government. And in particular, since any time you've got anything like identity tracking, there's no, you know, that's being handled by a private company. I mean, there's no reason why it can't be sort of sold on a secondary market, for example. And you couldn't, applying the basic rules of commerce, there's nothing you could really do to stop that short of a really robust contract essentially between the users of these services and the providers. And given the inequality in bargaining power between consumers and let's say Microsoft and MasterCard, you're not really going to get those terms where you can enforce and say, you know, yes, I'm agreeing to use this product, but you can't do anything with it that compromises my privacy or my security. That, how would you ever enforce that? And, mm-hmm. you know, there's many examples. I mean, whether it's private military contractors that are used by the U.S. government or private prisons, which are flourishing in some states, where the line between public and private ends up getting blurred in a way that is really an accelerant of certain inequities that are endemic in this society. So I just think as an operating principle, I never take any reassurance out of the distinction between private and public when it comes to these issues. And once you kind of strip away that assumption, then what are you left with? You're left with, you know, essentially marketing and sort of PR terminology that is being used to reassure consumers. Now,
yeah.
Whether you trust that or not, I think is a separate question. So the stripping all that aside and getting down to the other point, which is this is a fundamental advance in consumer technology. It's going to improve convenience and everybody's going to win. I can accept that. I think I've said before, and I think it's true, that most people will accept a huge incursion on their privacy in exchange for just a little bit of convenience. And without taking any kind of view on the morality or sort of long-term consequences of that, yes, I agree that it's inevitable. But I wish there were a more robust discussion about how is this going to be regulated to ensure that what is, you know, being stated about privacy and security ends up being true. And to my mind, there's very little reason to believe that it's going to work out in a way that's actually going to be beneficial to people in the long term.
That was very well said. And I realized as you were talking through it, that the reason I'm a bit more optimistic about this private enterprise approach is because the things that MasterCard said in response to inquiries from Fast Company sounded like they were operating within a regulated environment. They were the things that you would say if there were constraints on you as a company as to what you could and could not do and how you could do it. So it sounded like they were sort of getting out ahead of what might be inevitable regulation about whoever does this, and saying the right things. But you're right that there's no guarantee that that's what they need to or will eventually do. Evan, any final thoughts to close us out?
Well, it would be encouraging if, you know, there were assurances that the providers of these services aren't going to, you know, build in back doors or enter into agreements with the government where they would turn over information, you know, without a, you know, some kind of due process, you know, some kind of probable cause or some process like a subpoena or something like that. But I'm also wondering, again, this is just where I'm not a cryptographer, so shouldn't even be talking above my pay grade like this, we don't know what this is all going to be about. Wouldn't it be nice if the technology is one that doesn't lend itself well to abuses of this sort, because truly the power does reside in the individual? That's something that's very intriguing to me. What they're saying about this is that it's not going to be this honeypot of data that is going to be easily hacked, given out without authorization or shared with the government. You know, if there's something like that where the actual technological architecture of it makes it less likely to be abused to the detriment of somebody's privacy or civil liberties or something like that, then, you know, all the more reason to be optimistic And at the same time, taking very seriously the concerns that Stefan's raising there, which I think are well articulated.
Right. Before we leave the topic, Virgil in IRC raises an interesting point. He asks, isn't refusing to take legal tender illegal, hearkening back to this notion of businesses that choose not to take cash? And I think that's a really interesting question. I think you would have to couch it as some sort of civil rights violation or discrimination. My training in that area leads me to believe that if you were to try and sue over that, you might not have a sufficient case because not being a non-banking person is not a protected class that would get you through that door. Any other thoughts, gentlemen?
I can't imagine. I mean, you can set whatever kind of I guess you can't. You can't enter into a contract that has illegal subject matter, or there are certain things you can't contract to do. But it seems to me like you would have a hard time making an argument that you can't, as part of your freedom to enter into contracts and set conditions to your contract, that you can't determine what kind of payment to take. I don't know. It's an interesting issue. I've never researched it, but it just seems the world's a strange place. Maybe you could get in trouble for not taking cash. I don't know.
I could see a lawsuit being filed. I just don't know that it would get anywhere. What's your take, Stefan?
So I the first thing that came to mind was, this longstanding urban legend that sort of stamps are legal tender and you can pay for anything with a stamp. And if anybody refuses to accept the stamp as payment, it's illegal. And I was trying to figure out whether that's actually true or not. And I Googled it and found a New York Times story from October 2nd, 1862, in which there was a discussion about post office stamps as currency. And so I shared it in the chat group, but it's an archived New York Times article about a rebel Congress passing a law authorizing the issue of $5 million in copper coins of the denominations of 5, 10, and 25 cents and so on. And so there's this outrage being conveyed about the intrinsic value of currency and how that relates to post office stamps. So this is a longstanding debate that has happened as technology has evolved. And as the Civil War raged on, people were concerned about whether or not stamps could be treated as currency. And now we're wondering whether cash can still be treated as currency. So this is evergreen and interesting and worth researching. Like, I don't know the answer ultimately, whether it's illegal or not, but I know that this problem of somebody coming along and saying, you can't pay for this using legal tender, it has been thwarting people for some time, it turns out.
Wow. Good question, Virgil. Thank you. Let's move on. And since we're predicting the future and where things are headed, let's talk about the social web. Evan, I forget exactly when it was you got off Facebook and I think some other platforms too, but it was a while ago, like 2010, 2011.
Yeah, 2011. Right? 2011. And I never even signed up for a Google Plus account until they made me, as a condition. They remember there for a while you had to have a Google Plus account to use YouTube or whatever. So,
right.
So yeah, it's been a while.
It's been a while. So,
I have no idea what's going on in the world. And I have no friends, no, nothing, since I was never really active on Facebook after that. So I became a no one quickly.
You were way ahead of the curve, it turns out. And yes, of course, you have friends and a social life and probably a thriving relationship with the people in your life who matter to you. Talk about being on the leading edge, although not enough that the two of us bought Bitcoin in 2010. Over at the Recode Decode podcast with Kara Swisher and Casey Newton. Casey Newton predicted something that I've been seeing anecdotally among the young people in my life for some time, that people will decide to follow Evan's early 2011 lead and rely less and less on social platform for their interactions with people who matter to them. And that 2019 will be the year of the group chat. And that however, the best implementation of that, there's a lot of talk about in the podcast itself about Snapchat and whether that is the vehicle for it, or maybe Instagram, which is still under the Facebook umbrella, obviously. or iMessage on an iPhone or something more secure like Signal, whatever it is, what Casey Newton says is if you talk to people about the kind of social interactions they actually like, it's group text. Whether it's an iMessage, whether it's Snapchat, talking to a small group of friends, you know exactly who's there. You can share your in-jokes. You don't have to pose for people. You can just be dumb. There's none of this pressure. If you use an app like Snapchat, then all those chats can just disappear. As much, I would throw in the caveat, as much as they actually do that. They're not going to haunt you forever, or maybe you could just use iMessage and end-to-end encryption, and you feel like you're probably going to be fine. The other thing that I would add that he did not raise there is when you're using a platform like that, assuming it is an ad-free platform that is not scanning people's conversations to then try and serve them ads, you're avoiding that issue as well. So I think young people have gotten this for some time, and I wonder if the rest of us are going to follow suit. What do you think, Stefan?
So I have a group chat with some friends from law school, and when I compare the content of that group chat to the content of sort of other social media posts, one thing that stands out is how incredibly juvenile and vulgar the group chat becomes. Largely, I'm not excluding myself from this. I'm partially responsible for that. And I think there is something nice about being able to just, you know, goof around in a way that's feels private, even though it probably isn't. But, you know, is it really the future of this? There's too much money at stake, I think, on these social media platforms in terms of business models of giant companies. They're not going to just let everybody retreat away from it. So I'm a little skeptical that people are just going to kind of stop posing online, because there's a lot of reasons why people choose to do it, and those, they're sort of hardwired into people's brains. And so I could see the two kind of existing in parallel. You could still make your Instagram post, impress your friends, and then reveal sort of a darker, more intimate side in your group chat with your closer friends. And I think both of those things can exist in parallel.
Yeah, you're probably right. I feel like the impress your friends part of it has a commercial overtone to it, that there's no real reason to be posing quite so strenuously if you're not trying to monetize that in some way. And so that maybe those platforms will evolve more into, you know, this is what marketing looks like now. And certainly I think they're already a large way there. And that for more private, intimate, personal interactions, people will do what you and your juvenile friends are doing, Stefan. The other thing that occurred to me in sort of thinking this through is that there have definitely sprung up apps like Tripcast, which is, I think, a direct response to people not wanting to splash their, not wanting to pose to the public, not wanting to splash their vacation photos all over the place, but wanting to make sure grandma and grandpa know they had a good time at the national park kind of thing. So they can share with just a limited universe of people. It's designed for sharing your travel or other personal photos in a, to a very narrow casted grouping of people. I also, for some reason, thinking through this and thinking about group chat reminded me of something else from the earlier part of this decade, from 2010. Everyone remember Chat Roulette? And how that was going to be the future of the internet, where we'd just randomly encounter interesting strangers, and how quickly that devolved into the worst of the worst.
Don't say it.
Yeah, not going to say it. But this seems like a this tendency toward let's have a private group chat seems like a complete left turn from that energy that sparked someone to start Chat Roulette. And there are still, I looked this up before the show, there are still some how do I meet and connect with random strangers apps out there, but nothing that has the notoriety that Chat Roulette had back in the day. Any thoughts, Evan?
Well, I mean, this is interesting because, I mean, when we go, or I won't say when we go online, I'll just say when we communicate using our devices, we have different objectives depending on, you know, who we're talking to, what mood we're in, what we're doing, you know, when it is, and what have you. So, I mean, the fact that there's this rise in popularity of this phenomenon that Kara Swisher is identifying here as groups of people getting together to talk to the exclusion of everyone else. I mean, that certainly is nothing new. You know, it's why friends get together and go over to each other's house. Or, you know, in the 80s and 90s, if you remember what it was, a big deal. Here I am mentioning the old phone company again. I'm sounding like such a curmudgeon. But do you remember, it was a big deal. You get the new package on your home phone line. You get call waiting and three-way calling. You know, so imagine that, this new dimension of talking on the phone. You have three parties instead of two. So, you know, that's nothing new, that sentiment there. So I think there's, you know, just the technologies that are available provide, you know, for these types of communications to happen more easily, especially Snapchat. You know, I see my 13-year-old son particularly, you know, involved in these kinds of communications on there. And you know, I would also think that maybe among grown-ups there's a certain sense that these days, you know, in this day and age, you can't be too careful about what you say publicly. I don't know if you felt this way, Denise, back, you know, when you started blogging in 2001, you know, in the early days. You know, I sort of felt like, you know, when I started blogging, which was in 2005, I sort of had my community around people who would comment on my blog. I felt like I could have a conversation, and maybe it was a lack of wisdom and, you know, more maturity now. But I think I was probably less careful, and I was more likely to sort of be myself, so to speak, even publicly in the early days. And now that has changed. I think anybody with a reasonable amount of prudence is more careful about what they say online publicly. And so that might be some of this, probably not in the young folks who are doing this, but to the extent that there are adults in using these technologies more, there could be some of that. I'm just speculating.
Yeah, well, as P.S. Chops points out in IRC, we're all in IRC, Stefan, Evan, and I as well. Here we are in group chat, in very anciently created group chat, IRC technology. I don't remember the year of its inception, but it predates chat roulette by quite a bit. Your comment, Evan, made me think about, again, chat roulette. I guess it all comes back to chat roulette. How quickly those really supportive, intimate, positive communities of people we were interacting with who would, you know, when we would track who had linked to our blogs and go read what they'd said and then comment on their blog and they would come comment on ours, how quickly the comment feature became misused and toxic and became the place where like nefarious deals were going down and you had to become, you know, the Uber cop of your comments rather than having any fun or intellectual gratification from what you were writing or reading. So I don't know. Here we go. Rourke says IRC created in 1988. Happy to still be having it go strong. So IRC, group chat, other group chat. Stefan, were you going to add something?
I was. I had to laugh because as Evan was talking about sort of social media behavior, I have Twitter open here next to the IRC chat, and a journalist retweeted a tweet that our president made a few moments ago, and I'm going to read it just to kind of really get it into the record here, so to speak. The president of the United States just tweeted, "Mike Pompeo is doing a great job. I am very proud of him. His predecessor, Rex Tillerson, didn't have the mental capacity needed. He was dumb as a rock, and I couldn't get rid of him fast enough. He was lazy as hell. Now it is a whole new ballgame, great spirit at state." That is the president of the United States using social media, I think it just speaks for itself.
Yeah, it sure does. I don't have it in the rundown, but can we just for a moment talk about what is his official title? Rudy Giuliani is our cybersecurity czar or something, head of cybersecurity for the government, not understanding what a URL is or how they work. That was fun this week, too. Any thoughts, Evan? Evan, are you there? Are you muted?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I was. That's probably a good thing. I'm not going to touch this one anymore.
All right. Moving on. That was fun. I'm interested to see if group chat supplants other forms of media for how we actually interact with friends and family. Stay tuned, I guess, on that one. What's our next topic here? We're going to talk about terms of service next.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yes, isn't it, though?
Yeah. My pulse went up a little bit. You know.
I know. It's a great bumper. What also is bound to get your blood rushing is the whole notion of traveling the world and working remotely and meeting new people in real space and not on chat roulette. This is what WeRoam promised to people, that they were going to sort of automate the notion of being a digital nomad and set you up with airfares from one place to another and temporary housing in the various places you were going to nomad about to. But as some well-laid plans go, this one did not work out. WeRoam has gotten in touch with its members and with great sadness and remorse has announced that they are devastated to tell them that the company is no longer going to continue. Its dream and its family is not going to continue. And neither are all of these plans that people have paid for, in many instances, many thousands of dollars, to have what sounds like, you know, a great time, a great year or so vagabonding around the planet, making a living and having adventures. Interestingly enough, and we're talking about digital identity and managing things, the people who were able to get their money back were the people who had paid WeRoam via PayPal. PayPal honored the refunds for the company hasn't or can't. But PayPal said, yeah, if this vendor did not perform, we'll refund your money. So that's a good thing to bear in mind, I guess. I also just think it's interesting that we've arrived at a place where people who want to do this will put so much trust and give so much money to someone to sort of ease their way through the process when, you know, technically you could do this research and arrange an adventuresome year on your own. Maybe you don't have the resources to line up all of your employment and accommodations, but there is this thing called the internet, and it's far easier to research that kind of thing than it used to be. Any thoughts on this, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, it's sad to see a startup not succeed like this. I mean, most startups don't succeed. That's the brutal reality of things. And, you know, I mean, I feel bad for the people involved. I feel bad for the founders. I thought it was interesting to read that, at least according to this article, that one of the reasons why WeRoam as a company didn't do well is because it was paying so much money to settle a, I think it was a trade secrets dispute. And then it had also had some trademark problems. So let that be a cautionary tale to founders to, you know, do whatever due diligence you feel is maybe you should do more than what you feel is appropriate, you know, at the beginning, at the launch stage when it comes to the intellectual property you're using in your company. So I think the concept sounds really interesting. I'm sure these folks had a lot of high expectations for the fun they were going to have. And let's hope that, you know, maybe it's not a flaw in the overall concept as a business model, but maybe this particular iteration execution of it was, you know, had some problems that could be remedied in another go at it somewhere. So,
yeah, that was my thought too. This business model isn't going to go away, and someone can step in. There's clearly a market for people who want to do this, but they need somebody trustworthy and funded on the other end to make it happen. Stefan, any thoughts?
I, you know, echoing Evan, really just the IP drag on this seemed to doom them. And it's interesting because it seems like such a, you know, maybe I'm just taking for granted that it's an easy problem to avoid, but these guys didn't, it's not like this seemed like a subtle problem. I mean, it sounded like they kind of screwed up pretty early on, and it tracked them for the rest of their existence. It's sad when companies fail. This sounded like a pretty quixotic business model. As I understood it, it was kind of like a way to get people to live in different cities and continue working at their day jobs from remote locations and kind of shuffle around the world while doing it. I can't imagine that scales very well, but I guess I'm not a entrepreneur, so I don't know what thought went into this, but it kind of sounds like, well, of course it failed. I mean, how many people are going to use this service? But as I told someone who works at WeWork the other day, I never would have thought that idea would work, and here they are, a multi-billion-dollar company. So maybe there is a market for this. I don't know, but
That's the Seinfeld Friends thing again, because I always thought WeWork had a good business model, but that might be the big firm, small firm thing as well. I was reminded of the Fyre Festival a little bit by this, and wondering what the fallout of this is going to be. The reason I stuck it under our terms of service category is I'm sure the legalese around doing business with these people protects them. And doesn't provide any guarantees that people are going to have what they signed up for, or perhaps even have their money back if the company fails. But, is that going to be enough? A la the Fyre Festival I'm sure there will be lawsuits over, you agreed and you've breached. I'm wondering if there will also be fraud or, claims of fraud or prosecutions for fraud by attorneys general who think that something was dangled out that the company had never the ability or plan to deliver. I don't know the answers to any of those questions, but just think it's interesting to consider what the fallout will be here. Any other thoughts, Evan?
No, not really, other than to underscore that thing of fraud. I mean, no matter what the terms of service said, if they were, making people think that they were getting into something that they knew at that point they couldn't deliver on, I mean, that's starts to sound like fraud. And if they have enough facts that they can actually plead to keep it past a motion to dismiss, I'm sure you could see some fraud claims in a fact pattern like this.
Right. Okay, let's journey back to Evan's blog and talk about an evergreen topic, how we contract with one another in the online realm and which of those contracts are going to be enforceable. Evan, tell us about this iOS game developers terms of service.
Yeah, this had to do with a browse wrap agreement. It's an incomplete but helpful way of dividing up online contracts, either in being browse wrap terms where, you're presented with a link that if you click on it, it'll take you to the platform's terms of service. Then there are click wrap agreements where you actually have to click on the box, or if there's language that says by clicking this button, by doing this thing, you agree to the terms of service. Well, this was a set of facts where we had a game developer that was, making games available both in the Facebook environment and as downloads in the App Store, iOS, for your iPhone, iPad. And the issue that usually comes up, and it's what happened here, is there was a problem. I think in this case, it was the plaintiffs thought that they had lost money and that the games were actually unlawful gambling apps in violation of Washington state law. And the defendants wanted to arbitrate the case rather than have this heard in court. So they moved to compel arbitration, and the court said, no, this can be heard in court because the plaintiffs never agreed to arbitrate because the terms of service that you tried to present them to, they never were made aware of it because these were just agreements where you had to, for example, scroll down way too far and you would never be put on what they call inquiry notice, enough notice for you to think, oh, what is this? I ought to click on it and read these terms of service here. So it's a good reminder for developers, whether it's, plain old web development or more modern forms of development in, apps in whatever environment, that it's critical to make sure that you architect it in such a way that the users users are going to be aware of what those terms of service are so that you have evidence that there was a binding contract entered into between the parties. So it's a case study in that kind of good design and development principles.
Absolutely. And it's something that people, it's funny that they continue to get it wrong when there's a good deal of precedent out there now. Stefan, any thoughts?
Yeah, just circling back to the whole public versus private thing, I find it really this an interesting example that illustrates my point to some degree, which is, the trying to compel arbitration is a way of saying, I want to take this out of the public sphere and put it into the private sphere. And, why would a company want to do that? Well, because there's less scrutiny, everything is behind closed doors. And I think I haven't read the decision. It actually sounds really interesting, and I probably will read it. But I think it illustrates indirectly the point I was trying to make earlier about public versus private. And there's a lot of these situations where the first response is, well, let's get this into arbitration. And the reason is because I don't want anybody being able to see what I'm up to. Otherwise, I haven't read the decision yet. It sounds like a really interesting one, and I look forward to reading it, especially since it takes place very close to home in Washington State.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I promised Evan some Bitcoin stories since we are constantly kicking ourselves about not – we may have foresight about group chat, but not so much about cryptocurrencies. So I stuck these under Crimes and Justice.
Sounds a lot like AC/DC.
I know. Rocking out there. This one definitely involves, we should have stuck this one under terms of service maybe, because it definitely involves a terms of service violation. And it involves gift card fraud, which I guess we could call a crime, and which I found very, I was actually very pleased to stumble on this. Because for the holidays, I was shopping for a younger family member, what I have found about teen and college age people is they really just love to have you give them money if you can do that. They love to be able to go out and independently spend, and yet I'm unconsciously or subconsciously moving myself toward a cashless society because I never just sort of hand over wads of cash. They'd probably prefer that. But what I decided to do this year was go and get a gift card, like a gift Visa card that they could, because they're too young to qualify for a Visa on their own. It just seems sort of fun and special to be able to give them the idea of, here's my Visa card when it's not, it's something that is really just like a cash card. But I was surprised when I went to go do this at how stringently that process went, that there were fees involved in buying the thing and that my ID had to be forked over. And now I know, having read this piece at The Intercept, that there is this, as they say, the Wild West world of gift card not only Bitcoin brokering, but I guess fraud in general. This piece is really interesting. It's about a guy named Eric who makes his money buying and selling Bitcoin. But the reason the gift cards come into it is because he doesn't want to be taking cash from these people. He the gift cards are an easy way to have a cash equivalent compensate him. And I mentioned there are fees involved in these things. He can make money on the spread depending on, how he picks his gift cards and where he buys them. At the beginning of this, The Intercept's reporting on this, apparently Walmart had a lax standard on gift card purchases that, as the result of their reporting, was tightened up. And it makes the subject of their story's life more difficult. He on balance was happy about it because, wants the world to function in a non-fraudulent way, it sounds like, rather than just pad his own pockets. But, really fascinating story and just, window into the world of Bitcoin arbitrage. Evan, did you have anything to add on this?
Well, I admit that I didn't quite fully understand, you know, his methodology here. So it sounds mm-hmm. interesting, and it was one of those things. And I guess to the extent I don't understand it, I shouldn't comment on it too much. But it does seem like there could be a usefulness here of some universally trusted identity authenticating mechanism. So maybe there's a tie back to our MasterCard Microsoft collaboration. You know, so much of this depends on who you are. Not necessarily who your identity is, but making sure that you are who you purport to be. Is there a distinction between that and your identity? You know what I mean? It doesn't matter that you are a particular person. It's not that you have to know who somebody is, that they are, you know, John Smith at 123 Main Street, but that they are a person who's coming to the transaction with good funds for it. Mm-hmm. So,
right. It's so interesting. Point about this, I guess, is that gift cards can be used to sort of give you cash can be used this way too, but it's more, they do it with apps and yet it's untraceable if you're using a gift card, apparently. So it makes the digital processing easier. It's like creating cash in the digital arena. To use these things, and you're not, for that reason and maybe others, you're not supposed to resell them once you've bought them, and that was one way that the gentleman being profiled in this Intercept piece was violating the terms of service of the gift cards themselves. You're not supposed to resell them. Stefan, any thoughts on this?
I'm sure nothing gives Bitcoin enthusiasts the sheen of respectability they crave, like association with a Walmart gift card fraud. I think that really propels them into the highest echelons of liability in commerce. So
right.
I enjoyed this article for the way in which it reinforced my biases.
I know. Poor Aaron Wright, who we had on the show and episode 431, who's so above board in his scholarship on the blockchain. Yes, is cringing as we discuss this. Well, and the SEC seems to be a bit tainted by that kind of perspective as well, since they have announced something that I find pretty disturbing, actually, since we've been following smart contracts. We discussed them in the show with Aaron Wright. And have discussed them numerous times, that the blockchain runs on smart contracts and these microtransactions or macro transactions, you know, people buying and sell real property may be done by smart contract way more routinely than it is now. But what can also be done, of course, is selling things that may or may not be securities, which is under the purview of the SEC. Mm-hmm. And the SEC has announced they're maybe not going to make a distinction between the developer of the smart contract code and the end user who may be selling an unregistered security. If the creator of a smart contract used to facilitate decentralized trading can be identified, that individual could conceivably be held liable for securities violations, according to this piece at Bitcoin.com that we have in our rundown today. So the upshot is, this article points out that perfectly legitimate smart contract developers who, you know, are not merely doing what they're doing to help people sell things that may or may not constitute securities law violations may wish to code anonymously so as not to come under the scrutiny of the SEC. Now, query how anonymous you have to be to escape the SEC's purview. What do you think of this, Evan?
I think this is interesting. I mean, my first thought of, well, it's like, yeah, that's problematic because you're placing potential liability on just this developer of a technology for what users of that technology do, right? You know, a smart contract is still a contract between two people. And in this situation, they're looking to pin liability on not necessarily either of the two people who entered into the legal relationship in accordance with the smart contract, but the one who provided that technology to be utilized. So as with so many things, you know, maybe analogies are helpful. So let me introduce this analogy. And if we can figure out where it breaks down, maybe that's going to be enlightening. there's two analogies, really. First of all, I thought, well, could this be like Section 230? I know it's not Section 230 kind of stuff, but where you there could be some kind of immunity for the technology provider arising from what the users of the technology do. That's what, you know, Section 230 immunity discusses. But then I thought, well, maybe this is more like pimping. You know, John comes to a pimp, the legal relationship sometimes is between the John and the pimp, but the legal relationship could also be between the John and the prostitute. But the pimp can still be liable, right? Even though, so let's assume that the facts established that the contract is between the John and the prostitute. The pimp, by establishing this scenario where these two parties can come in and break the law together, he can still be liable. Is the developer of the smart contract technology the pimp in that analogy?
I appreciate what you're doing here. I don't think that Google and every other online platform probably appreciate that they are now, for purposes of this analogy, in the role of the pimp. But because do you have to be one or the other, right? I'm sure you could find lawmakers who would say, if what you're peddling is illegal services, then you're the pimp.
Well, isn't that what isn't that what makes a pimp liable? The peddling of illegal transactions is what pimp liability is.
Right. So which came first, the transaction or the illegality or the pimp status, I guess, is what we're getting at here. I really don't know. I think it's a good analogy to bring out. My Friends versus Seinfeld take on it is code can be used for many a purpose and doesn't always have to be used for prostitution.
Yeah, I was hoping the analogy would break down pretty quickly, and that's where we'll figure something out here.
Yeah.
Stephen, I'm not going to try to defend it, you know.
Yeah, can you help us?
I'm sort of imagining now the guy who sold me the paper that I used to draft an old-fashioned contract is now a pimp. Like so the analogy, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure that it quite works. I guess what I'm missing is the link to, you know, why would the code drafter be liable? They don't necessarily have control in how the code is used, just as you don't have control over how paper is used if you sell it. Like if I were to sell you a stack of paper and you were to use it to draft a contract to kill somebody and the contract was enforced and somebody was killed, surely the person who sold the paper wouldn't be liable. And so I must be missing something here in the analogy, because it's just not, I don't see how you get to the coder.
Yeah. What I'm not missing is the opportunity to make everybody pimps our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And you can just imagine my internal delight at some fastidious oversight body saying, oh, you know, can you show us the passphrases to make sure that you actually watched or listened? And this will be one. So thank you for that, Evan. Let's move on from the SEC's approach toward smart contracts and those who code them to Ohio, where it's possible this year for the first time to pay your taxes in Bitcoin if you are a business. It's only for businesses, and it's only for Bitcoin. None of the other 2,500 some odd cryptocurrencies will work for the state of Ohio. There is an initial 3-month introductory period where there are zero transaction fees, and then you're going to be charged 1% thereafter for paying in Bitcoin. I just thought that was interesting. What do you think, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, my first impression is this Robert Wood, who wrote this story that we read, you know, on Forbes, mm-hmm. he did something in the first paragraph that I would be less likely to do than, you know, like go skydiving or something else. And that is like make some bold suggestion on how you ought to handle your taxes. So that's you know, kudos to him for that. So seems legit. If he says it is, you know, I guess that's how I'll use all this Bitcoin I have. pay my taxes in Ohio.
He actually goes into some detail about, you know, when you bought your Bitcoin and if you have gains or losses on it and how that will figure into your payment of taxes in the state of Ohio when you pay them using your vast Bitcoin
reserves. That's the interesting part of how you actually treat the loss. And that's, wow, there's a lot wrapped into that. So,
yeah, there is. Stefan, you going to be paying your taxes with cryptocurrency anytime soon?
No, I don't pay taxes. I just, I'm just kind of hoping it, just hoping it works out as a sovereign citizen.
There we go. That's why we had this under crimes and justice. I get it now. All right.
There you go.
There we go. Let's move on and talk about robots and AI and such.
Woo. Yeah.
A couple of interesting developments in the autonomous vehicle arena. We now know the details. We talked a bit last week about the fellow in Palo Alto who fell asleep at the wheel. Just wanted to add that there's been more detail released by the police who intercepted him and his car. That it apparently went, this is just fascinating. Do you remember we were talking with Steve Embry and he had a Tesla and was saying, you know, I don't know how this works because you get a warning as soon as your hands are not on the steering wheel. And no one seems to really know how or why this worked. But this guy who apparently had fallen asleep at the wheel and was charged with drunk driving was able to drive 7 miles for 7 minutes. So I guess that means he was going 60 miles an hour before they, you know, if my math on that is right, before the police got in front of the car and slowed it down so that it stopped on its own. So that's a little scary that someone could fall asleep at the wheel of their Tesla on autopilot and have it drive 7 miles at it sounds like a good clip before anybody could bring it to a halt. Any thoughts on that, Evan?
I wonder if, you know, 50 years, this is going to be one of those things where somebody stumbles across this story. And it's like, oh, isn't that quaint? They were trying to figure out how you handle intoxicated, you know, driving when it's not really driving. So just seems like a natural, the story is an occurrence in the natural progression of how our thinking will evolve on these things, because clearly, you know, assuming that, you know, there's not going to be another effort at prohibiting the use of alcohol. People are going to continue to drink and they're going to continue to move from place, you know, point A to point B in automobiles. And so, you know, there's a certain positive effect on, I guess, public policy, encouraging people to not actually drive, but to use self-driving cars to the extent that technology is available. So, you know, it's just this natural step in the progression of how we'll think and make policy on these things.
Yeah, another person in the Bay Area was intercepted back in January on the Bay Bridge, of all places. Police woke him up, but he told them, well, everything was okay because I was on autopilot. And I could, you know, maybe he was under the influence when he said it. But for now, being on autopilot is not an exception in California by any means to drunk driving laws. That could very well change, Evan, as you are pointing out. Any thoughts, Stefan?
Now, I'm no small town plaintiff's lawyer, but if I were, I'd be asking, you know, what is Tesla putting in their marketing materials and their user manuals that's making these people think that they can do this? And if it's sort of encouraging this, although I think Evan's right, in 50 years, it will seem quaint. Right now, this is essentially a beta test mode that they've outsourced to the general public on roads that are being used by people who may not be aware that the guy in the car next to them is drunk and asleep. And the technology is not advanced to a stage yet where, you know, I personally would be comfortable with that. So if this is one of those situations where you're being told, oh, go ahead and do this, this is safe.
I would be stunned to find marketing materials to consumers of Teslas that would lead them to think that would be the case. But as you said, lawyers can get pretty creative.
Or even using the phrase autopilot. I mean, if they're saying autopilot, how would you interpret that? I mean,
bottoms up.
Indeed. Well, Congress is getting there maybe faster than the state of California has. But it actually doesn't sound like they're going to, you know, because of the way that Congress works or doesn't work, that this bill is going to make its way into a law. But there is a bill pending called the AV Start Act that could, you know, who knows what's going to happen to this thing. It probably won't be enacted immediately, but it could get tacked on to some spending bill, the way budget bill, the way that these things happen. It seems to have some criticism from the Democratic side of the aisle. It's going to, here, let me tell you what the bill will do. If enacted, it will loosen up many of the federal regulations pertaining to self-driving vehicles. AV manufacturers like Tesla and GM would be able to develop and market those vehicles without specific regulatory action. At the same time, the bill would collect crash information federally for level two driving systems like Tesla's Autopilot and GM's Super Cruise. Now, this is really interesting. This legislation also has the power to determine what these vehicles look like in the future, allowing for automakers to manufacture vehicles without steering wheels, gas, and brake pedals, so long as the Department of Transportation exempts them from the federal motor vehicle safety standards. These new changes to the bill would require vehicles without these traditional systems like steering wheels to pass all other existing occupant protection requirements. So you can kind of see why there might be a partisan divide on this on the conservative side. Let's promote development and business and not have a lot of regulation. And on the Democratic side, let's make sure these cars are safe. So, again, I don't think, based on the reporting on this bill, that sort of procedurally it's headed for passage anytime soon. But it's interesting to see Congress looking at the notion of, yeah, you know, we're designing these systems so that an autonomous vehicle really doesn't need to have a driver. So gas, steering wheel, brake, et cetera, may be irrelevant. What do you think about that, Stefan?
So I haven't read the details of this. So I don't know. I don't really have an opinion on whether they're kind of moving in the right direction or not. I do think it's interesting that that they're thinking about this in advance, that they're really being a feasible commercial product. I think that's encouraging. I think often with new technologies, you see sort of a bunch of mistakes being made, and then people try to rein in a market that already exists. Here, it seems like they're getting out ahead of it, which is encouraging. It's interesting to remember that Ralph Nader got his start. I don't know if it was a start, but he really made a splash with a book criticizing the auto industry for not being safe. And a lot of what came out of that we now take for granted as a basic feature of any car that we buy. And it's because regulation sort of informs engineering. And I think that's a good thing. And I hope that there can be this nice symbiotic relationship between the innovators who are pushing their design choices forward with the public at large, having an expectation that this will be done safely. And I think, I hope that's an open public debate and everybody gets a voice in it.
Yep. Good points. Evan?
I always think it's interesting how as a nation with state law and federal law, how these regulations, and I'm using that with a small r, you know, sort of how we regulate things like driving and automobiles and safety and specifications and all this stuff actually comes to be. And so that's so interesting just to see how the different players, namely the federal government, the state governments, the manufacturers and consumers are all interacting here to see how this will be shaped. And all of this, of course, is overlaying the real, still, I think you could characterize it as a disruptive technology of self-driving mm-hmm. vehicles. So just interesting to see how we as a society manage these things and move them along progressively.
Yeah. You know what else is interesting to me, at any rate, Evan, is hearing you talk about laws about driving makes me think about how many times on the show when you were co-hosting with me, we talked about the laws of hands-free technologies. Using your cell phone or other communication device in your car and how different states treated it differently. Now we're just talking about throwing the steering wheel out. You don't have to have your hands on the steering wheel. You don't have to have a steering wheel. So we've come a long way, baby.
What a difference a decade makes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So another thing that has come a long way that I don't know if lots of people have heard about, it seems to be sort of getting launched a little quietly, is that Waymo has launched the first self-driving taxi service. And it's going to work in the Phoenix area. It's, you're not going to be able to land at the airport there and hit up their app and get your robo car. You already have to be in their pilot testing program to be able to start using the taxi service. But you have the privilege, if you're in that program, to start paying to have an autonomous vehicle drive you about. The other thing to bear in mind for if you're concerned about the people in that being beta tested on, as Stefan aptly put it, is that there is actually going to be a human being behind the steering wheel as this self-driving taxi service is rolled out and tested. A Waymo employee will monitor the vehicle from the driver's seat. So these cars do have brakes and gas pedals and steering wheels and things. And hopefully these Waymo employees aren't lulled into a false sense of what their responsibilities are by the fact that their vehicles are using something that is called something like autopilot.
they'll just all be drunk.
Yeah,
it's no
exactly.
Big deal. You know.
Yep. Going for a drive. Get ready. Get your vodka ready. Final story on the robot front. I just thought that you would all like to know that MIT is, researchers at MIT are creating a way for plants to drive their own robots. there are a couple of researchers who have figured out they're at the MIT Media Lab, and they have figured out how to use the electrochemical signals that plants give out to communicate with a small robot car so that the plant can drive itself around to where it wants to be to get the best lighting situation for its growth. So this is super interesting. It made me think about, once again, Aaron Wright, who we had on our blockchain show back on episode 431, and his colleague or friend, Primavera Di Filippi, who had plantoids that were autonomous plants on the blockchain. Now, maybe Primavera's plants can drive themselves around as well. But all kidding aside, this does seem like really interesting technology for maximizing the ability of crops to grow with the most efficiency and productivity. If plants are able to have some sort of greater say, you know, they already sort of lean toward the light on their own. If they can have a bit more mobility in making sure that they're getting maximal conditions for their growth and productivity. What do you think, Stefan?
Physician, heal thyself. You know, it's a plant, water yourself.
Yeah.
I actually think it's really interesting. When I was reading this morning, I was thinking about, you know, if you really got this technology down, how interesting would it be to have medical devices that essentially detect early stages of some health problem developing and provide some form of, you know, therapeutic, you know, whether it's an injection that automatically is released from whatever little thing you've got installed in yourself, or there's just a little buzz that tells you, hey, you know, a cell has just morphed into a cancerous cell. You know, go seek treatment right away before the spiral is out of control. And having that kind of biological electronic interface that sort of monitors and adjusts and informs in real time as things are developing is going to be very powerful. And I don't think there's going to be a single person who turns down that ability once it becomes real, as creepy as it sounds at this time. So I personally find this kind of interface between electronics and biological life to be really fascinating, and excited to see how it develops.
Yeah, me too. I'm also excited to know whether, Evan, you'd be more terrified tooling around the Phoenix area of getting hit by a self-driving car, a self-driving taxi from Waymo, for example, or around the MIT campus where you might be clocked by a self-driving plant.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in Phoenix they put a saguaro in one of these carts, and I would be afraid of that because it's a sticky situation. So
it is indeed.
Here's where I see this going. I was really captivated by the sentence in this article that said, it was quoting one of the scientists, says, "The agency of such movements rests with the plant." And I love that. I picked up on that because, you know, philosophers and theologians have talked about this distinction between free agency and free will, you know, sort of the agency being the capacity to actually make decisions. So where this will go, maybe it won't, since the Naruto case didn't go the way it did. But I was thinking, mm-hmm. if plants can have agency, then they ought to have culpability, right? And the capacity to have liability assigned to them. So, you know, it's not going to be the developers of these torts who are sued, or of these carts who are sued for tort when one of these things runs over somebody's foot, but it's going to be the plants themselves because they have the agency to decide, you know, where to go. So these technologies are enabling them to have their own self-determination.
Yes, and since Primavera Di Filippi's plantoids are on the blockchain, they no doubt have unlimited access to less than above board Walmart Visa cards that they could pay off any sort of plant-related liability with.
But how will we know it's really that plant? So
exactly. Their identity is up for grabs. Let's do one final story on legislation and policy before we wrap the show.
Oh, I was hoping it would still be this bumper.
It is. We can never let that one go. Except I don't know if you've seen our Halloween show, Evan, but Victor cobbled together some wonderful holiday Halloween bumpers for us, and I particularly liked the legislation one there, too. This week we have a significant development. The first time a Western government has enacted a law that will allow its law enforcement in limited circumstances, and we can talk about that, have access, once they've gotten a warrant, to have access to communications on a suspect's device, regardless of what kind of encryption is on that device. And the manufacturers of devices under this law have to cooperate with law enforcement. They have to provide technical assistance. They might have to build a new capability that would enable them to give assistance if it does not already exist. So we are right back to that San Bernardino shooting episode and Apple locking or unlocking, you know, coding together a new OS at the behest of law enforcement, which it declined to do. Here in Australia, laws requiring that are definitely becoming more of a reality. But we should point out that this will be, these powers to backdoor technology for this purpose will be limited to serious crimes defined as terrorism and child sexual offenses or other offenses with a term of imprisonment of 3 years or more. And there are various others, checks on the law. In other words, law enforcement does not just willy-nilly have access because, as you might imagine, this has been controversial in getting it passed. So any thoughts, Evan?
No, I trust the government now completely after listening to Stefan today.
All right.
No big deal. No, I mean,
go Aussies.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, I mean, it's the same, it's an iteration of the same principle we've talked about, this sort of tension between individual liberty and, you know, our personal, the security of our own civil liberties and the security we get from being protected by the government. So, you know, the idea of the government having concern over the use of encryption tools is nothing new. Let's hope that it can be implemented in a way that's balanced and won't be abused. I know it'd be subject to abuse, you know, reading what constitutes terrorism broadly, what constitutes the sort of prohibited sex crime, you know, the same, I guess it'd be the same genre of concerns that people have had about FOSTA and CESTA. You know, will mm-hmm. now intermediary liability be expanded because of people taking very broad approaches to those types of things, those kinds of abuses here? So let's just hope that it can be implemented and executed in a way that does strike a fair balance between the duty of the government to protect its citizens from harm and the obligations to provide them with security in their own civil liberties.
Yeah. And at least here in the U.S., I can think of a lot of crimes that aren't sexual offenses or child sexual offenses or terrorism that involve sentences of 3 years or more. I mean, 3 years seems like a pretty low threshold there. Yeah. What do you think, Stefan?
I assume Evan was being somewhat facetious, but I will defend my stance and point out that it's, I'm not saying you should trust the government. What I'm saying is if in the event that you do not trust the government and you wish to seek recourse for some action it's doing, that will play out in a public forum as opposed to something that a company is doing will not play out in a public forum. And therefore, if there's an absence of trust vis-a-vis yourself and a private company, your recourse is going to be more limited. And so it's not about trusting the government. It's about doing things in a way that is subject to public scrutiny so that in the absence of trust, you can act on your impulse to rein them in. And so that's the distinction I was going for, but I assume he was just giving me a hard time. So
yes.
In any case.
He does that.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, I appreciate it, but I didn't want anybody walking away with the impression that I am some sort of naive pro-government all the time. anyway,
yeah, not at all.
But not at all. No, just I like scrutiny. That's all. But the I mean, you know, I don't know enough about this particular bill to say again whether this is going about it the right way or the wrong way. I think, you know, forcing companies to allow the government to burrow into encrypted communications. I'm not saying I would always be against it under every circumstance, but this doesn't. And from what I do know about this, it doesn't seem particularly informed by the concerns of people who value privacy. And for that reason, I think it sounds like it's probably swinging too hard in the wrong direction. And hopefully will be monitored and commented upon and reformed to be less draconian.
It will certainly be monitored. It definitely seems like something that could be the beginning of a slippery slope of Western governments going, oh, well, Australia's doing it and nothing's too terrible has happened to them as a result.
When
and
has anybody
interdicting
ever
a lot more crime. Sorry?
When has anybody ever followed Australia's lead in anything?
Outback Steakhouse is pretty good.
Bloomin' onion, baby. Get that in your Fosters and jump in your self-driving car and head off across the Bay Bridge and... It'll be all good. All right. Let us conclude this show with our resources of the week. Let's start with those. Number one, you were talking earlier eloquently, Evan, about the public domain and copyright law in general. It's a good opportunity, I think, to plug the fact that as of January 1st, 2019, this will be the first time since 1998 that works in the U.S. enter the public domain. Works from 1923 will do so at that time. Not each and every work will. There are some technicalities as to whether people renewed their copyrights and did, you know, basically crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's to make sure they had a valid copyright that was then able to lapse. Assuming that all of the conditions have been met, we'll have a slew. It's actually tens of thousands of works that will enter the public domain in the U.S. in 2019, as of January 1st. And I guess my resource, if you're excited about that and you feel like celebrating it, you might want to, and you're in Northern California or can be there on January 25th, Creative Commons is going to have a party, a grand day of celebration for the public domain. They're calling it the grand reopening of the public domain. There's going to be a party. Many great people are going to be there, including Larry Lessig, Corinne McSherry. Larry Lessig, of course, aside from being a very renowned professor and author, is one of the founders of Creative Commons. Corinne McSherry is the legal director of the EFF, Cory Doctorow, who's been on our show many times, will be there. Pam Samuelson, copyright scholar from UC Berkeley, the CEO of Creative Commons will be there. Lots and lots of, I'm sure, folks happy to welcome the next round of works into the public domain. And then there's also, if the daytime party was not enough, they're doing a nighttime thing at the Yerba Buena Center for Arts for Paul D. Miller, who is also known as DJ Spooky. He's doing something called Quantopia, The Evolution of the Internet, a live concert synthesizing data and art, both original and public domain materials in tribute to the depth and high stakes of free speech and creative expression involved in our daily use of media. So all of that sounds really, really fun.
That's about as California of an event as I can imagine. So
exactly. I don't know if it's going to be one of those things where I'd really want to be there, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to go, much like I have never been able to make it out to Austin for the festivities there either. But we'll see. Yep. We'll see how late January shapes up for me. Also, I wanted to highlight as a resource something I just heard about yesterday. Last week on the show, as a resource, I suggested, you know, we're in the holiday gifting season here. Happy sixth day or night of Hanukkah, everyone, today as we record. I suggested that maybe doing some sort of supporting journalism would be a nice gifting enterprise. And I learned of something yesterday that people should look into. Jay Rosen was on The Daily Show yesterday, Professor Jay Rosen from NYU, renowned journalism scholar. He is involved in something called The Correspondent, the U.S. iteration of a Dutch journalism enterprise that is completely funded, supported by its users. It's subscription only, so you pay to subscribe, and then you get, there's no ads whatsoever, there's no targeting whatsoever, there's very in-depth journalism. Professor Rosen said yesterday in describing the kinds of things they're going to do, they're never going to talk about a problem without also exploring solutions. So it really seems like something worthwhile at least to look into and possibly put on your holiday gifting if you think that someone you know might enjoy supporting this. They're in the process of attempting to raise money to launch the English language version. So check out The Correspondent and see if that is something that interests you or might interest your family and friends. Our tips of the week, we've got a couple. Cory Doctorow, who I just referenced, has a great post at Boing Boing, just kind of like a common sense thing to do that hadn't really occurred to me. It might not have occurred to you. You know how there are these people finder sites that buy up commercial databases, and basically if you ever Google your home address, you will be stunned to find that people can find out where you live from various free sources. You can find instances of where this has happened if you just set up a Google alert, and then it's kind of a pain, but every time you see that it has happened, you have to message that database, find the appropriate form, and ask for removal of your information. So if you don't want to be in those databases, just set up a Google alert, and every time it's happened, you'll know, and then you can ask to be removed. Our other tip of the week comes from Victor in the studio. It's something that happened in his hometown of Vallejo, California. Again, maybe this is the most California thing that you'll have heard of today, Evan. A rapper, there's apparently a couple of rappers who are not happy with each other. A San Francisco rapper named Messy Marv, Marvin Messy Marv Watson Jr., is unhappy with a Vallejo rapper named Jamal J. Diggs Diggs. And rode on over to Vallejo and then proceeded to film himself getting out of the car. There was a little girl on a bike nearby. He's armed as he's walking around looking for this Vallejo rapper, wondering where he is, telling nearby folks, tell him I came looking for him kind of thing. And the Mercury News was quick to point out the several potential chargeable offenses that are involved in particularly in doing this. But I guess our tip is, if you must do this kind of thing, just as you don't want to, you know, be that flight attendant who filmed themselves doing inappropriate things in the airplane and then posted it to social media, you probably don't want to be that rapper who brings along someone who's going to film you threatening the other rapper. Because now the police are very aware that this has happened and several chargeable offenses are implicated. It's illegal to brandish guns in public. It's you're not supposed to have a gun or ammunition as a convicted felon. And this rapper was such. You're not supposed to point a loaded gun at anyone. That can be prosecuted as assault with a deadly weapon. And brandishing a gun around children can be prosecuted under California's Child Endangerment Penal Code. So if you're a rapper, be less, what's the word I'm looking for? Not thirsty, but what is it when you're very braggy online? There's a term. I'm spacing on it. Anyway, be less that.
Well, is the tip to just do it in group chat then?
Yeah, I guess the group chat is where that belongs. Precisely. And then coming up on the holidays, throwing it back a couple of years to an image that went up on Reddit then, our animal selfie of the week. We appear to have a cat take an animal selfie. I don't know. Its appearances can be deceiving. It almost looks as though the cat is reaching out its paw to trigger the shutter. So I'm going with, this is a legit selfie of the cat. And it, of course, could in no way be photoshopped, enhanced, or deceiving in its imagery whatsoever. Who would ever do that? But the caption on Reddit is, "Quick pic of me and the tree before I destroy it." So absolutely love that. My dog has already about taken our tree down two or three times during the holiday season. We're not that far into it.
You got a pretty fancy tree, didn't you?
Me? No, I got an Amazon tree, but it's quite nice. It's not that fancy.
Isn't it like a real tree, right?
It's a real tree. Like? Yes.
Yeah. It was shipped. Yeah. Maybe that's not a big deal. I saw that its journey, I think, on Twitter, right? And I thought, wow.
I posted a couple of pictures on Twitter. I did it just to basically see what it would be like to order a tree from Amazon. It came in a great big box. It was all wrapped up in twine. And when you clipped the twine, it somehow blossomed into a lovely actual tree that looked like it had just come home on your car, but it didn't. It came in a box from Michigan. So it was an interesting experiment. So far, it's holding out great. It hasn't dried out any faster than our other Christmas trees generally do. Evan, any final thoughts?
On you.
Sorry? What?
Unfortunately, it's spying on you.
It is. It is. Yeah. When we say Alexa, it perks right up. Oh, guys, it's been so, so fun to do the show with you here today. Stefan, great fun getting together with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy work schedule and joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to think about something other than the brief I was writing for a couple hours.
Yay. We're glad we were able to distract you. Yes, no fun whatsoever, but have a restful weekend anyway, or try to.
Ha
ha. Ha. At least, eat, drink, don't neglect yourself. I know how it is. I've written those kinds of briefs before. It's not fun. You tend to let things slide. So don't do that.
Stay in your briefs.
Yes, stay in your briefs and consume enough nutrition to keep you going. Please, for us. Evan, it is so nice to see you.
Yeah, for sure. I've really enjoyed this. This has been a lot of fun. I remember the good old days doing this every Friday afternoon. And so I remember what I enjoyed so much about it. And I tell you what, it's a great way to stay current. Certainly listening to the show, watching the show is one thing. Participating in it is another. So I'm really grateful for the chance to be here. And I've enjoyed it a lot. Stefan, very nice to talk with you. I've really enjoyed our conversation particularly. So thank you.
You're welcome back anytime. Just hit me up. Let me know when you're free.
I appreciate
that. We'll put you on
that.
As much as you'll let us do it. Really enjoyed hanging out with both of you. Oh, and hi to Matt. If he tunes into the show, Matt couldn't be with us this week. But
he's hanging
we'll
out on Chat Roulette.
Yes, exactly. He's got his group chat going. Hopefully not on Chat Roulette. Things you don't know about your co-hosts. I've ask no questions. But for all of you, you might question when you can join us live. Well, we record this show at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC this time of year. Head on over to twit.tv and click where it says watch live now. And you can do that as we record the show. And you can jump into our 1988 era chat room at irc.twit.tv, where we love having private group chat amongst ourselves as we do the show. And I'm so grateful that people do tune in live to the show and jump in there, because we really enjoy having the audience and the feedback from the audience as we record. But don't worry about it if that doesn't work for you. It's not obligatory. You can head on over to twit.tv. /twill, which is our show page, and our whole archive of shows, including many, many shows featuring Mr. Evan Brown, who we're thrilled was able to join us today, are there for you. So dig back in. Evan and I were saying before the show that it's hard to go back and watch those early shows because we were really young then, and time takes its toll. But we're thrilled that you're sticking with us through thick and thin, or that you've joined us for the first time. We hope that you've enjoyed being with us here today, talking about technology and the law, and that you'll continue to do so. Over on that show page, there are various ways to enjoy the show that are spelled out. Whether you're someone who likes to listen or watch on a watch, or kick back on your couch and see us in living color on your big screen on the wall, it's all possible, and instructions are there for you. If you're interested in various ways of consuming not just this show, but everything that Twit has to offer, we will be back next week. We're going to record at a slightly different time next week because the Twit holiday party approaches, and we're going to get out of their way next Friday so that they can be more festive. We're going to record at 9 o'clock Pacific time next Thursday if you'd like to join us then. Other than our best of, that'll be our last show of the year. So I hope you're able to make it. We're very glad that you're able to get in touch with us between the shows as well. Please continue to do that. I'm Denise at twit.tv, or you can email the show in general, twill@twit.tv. Find us on Twitter. In general, just let us know what you stumble upon on the web that you think we should be paying attention to, and people you think we should be talking to, and we will follow up, I promise you. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.